Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulubi. This week on Culturetopia, in a remote corner of Colorado, a new $38 million museum's just opened its doors. It's funded by one of the country's richest Native American tribes. We've got a talk with a couple of Broadway stars who've made a big splash this season, and a look at summer television. Critic Eric Deggan says it's not all reruns anymore. But first,
imagine this hot and anxious American summer that you're invited to the perfect cocktail party. Chrome-plated cocktail shakers abound. There are hats and bags and little black dresses that look like they belong on the cover of Vogue or Harper's. In fact, many were on the cover of Vogue or Harper's. We're in Providence at the Museum of Art, Rhode Island School of Design, or RISD, and its cocktail culture exhibit. It is intoxicating. There we met curators Lori Brewer and Kate Irvin. Cocktails, Lori Brewer told us, really got going when Prohibition started in 1919. Flavored mixtures obscured the taste of bathtub gin. But it wasn't just mixer and spirits being blended behind closed doors. It was the sexes.
No longer are women in another room having a cup of tea while the gentlemen are enjoying something stronger. And it's the fashions actually support what's happening during this rule-breaking period.
Mores changed. Women got the vote. In time, a whole culture revolved around the cocktail hour. Men, who had in the 19th century only drunk in gentlemen's clubs or saloons, now had a new role to play. Of course, in the history of the universe, no one mixes a drink better than the actor William Powell, otherwise known as Nick Charles in the slightly pixelated high society screen classic The Thin Man.
Always have rhythm in your shaking. Now, a Manhattan, you shake to foxtrot time. A Bronx, to two-step time. But a dry martini, you always shake to waltz time.
At the entrance to the cocktail culture exhibit, Lori Brewer pointed to a large, beautiful, chrome-plated shaker service.
It's the barware where we see the masculinity. And so with something as substantial as this cocktail shaker, this monumental silver piece, when filled, you can only imagine a gentleman would be strong enough to pick it up and shake this piece. And so we see the gentleman's role in the cocktail hour coming into play with these pieces.
Say, how many drinks have you had?
This will make six martinis.
All right. Will you bring me five more martinis? Leo, line them right up here.
Yes, ma'am.
Matthew Bird, a designer and critic, teaches industrial design at RISD.
When you look at this, you're thinking about the materials. Mm. When I look at it, I think, that looks like Rockefeller Center to me.
Which it's supposed to. This set has eight cups and the cocktail shaker, and it's on a tray, a rectangular tray. So everything about the cups and the cocktail shaker is cylindrical and tall and looks like a building. And then the tray is a platform with these horizontal bands. But the tray was already in manufacture by the Revere Company that made this. And in this case, I think it is Rockefeller Plaza as a result of that funny collage effort.
I try to imagine my husband at home in a tuxedo and jacket pouring me something from this service. We'll have to work on that. He does at least own a tuxedo. In the meantime, Lori Brewer shows me how the clothes had to work with the elegance of the shaker service. A mannequin wore one of my favorite gowns by an American designer called Elizabeth Hawes.
We call her the olive in the martini.
So this is addressed, the olive in the martini. I like that name. And it's just breathtaking. Green and olive silk dress with red accents. But you just used the word, the reveal. And it's like that, this red splash that emerges. Peekaboo.
And suddenly I realize, that the red in the olive dress is the pimento. Then dresses got shorter. Curator Kate Irvin points out there's another benefit to those roaring 20s hemlines.
We're seeing those legs being kicked up dancing to the Charleston. And so then imagine these embellished dresses with a swinging fringe moving and capturing the dim light within the clubs.
They played and they traveled. And one of the things you could do during Prohibition when you traveled was drink. Again, critic Matthew Bird.
Luxury liners, which were new, could get out into international water pretty quickly from New York City, and the drinking could begin all the way to Europe.
As Prohibition ended in 1933, the Depression deepened. Movies were the great escape, and they featured the cocktail. According to the Cocktail Culture Exhibition Catalog, 10 million people went to the movies on a daily basis in the early 1930s. Noel Coward wrote, "For gin, in cruel and sober truth, supplies the fuel for flaming youth." In 1939, 140 feature films were made, and 137 of them mentioned alcohol. Even this one, Claire Booth Luce's The Women.
"What you need is a wee drinky of this good corn liquor."
"No, thanks. Is that invitation general, Countess?"
"Yes, indeedy. As we say on the range. Here's to freedom. Day after tomorrow I shall be free. Free as a bird."
And increasingly, women ventured into that glittering sphere alone. Well, not totally alone. They took their hats and cocktail bags with them. And to look at the ones here, the glamorous cocktail bag was more like a miniature theater marquee.
These bags, they're designed to sit proudly atop the bar. You're not hiding these on the hook underneath the bar. You're putting them right up front and center. And of course, women are traveling together. So in many ways, you are dressing for one another because most of the men are gone away at war.
After World War II, Americans began cultivating the art of the resort getaway for the middle class, and cocktails went along. Mai Tais and tiki bars, for example, and Hawaii, margaritas and mariachis and Acapulco. And the resort wear went with it, hand-painted and themed. I must say I'm really admiring this brown and black cotton and sequin dress, because guess what? I found exactly this same skirt in a vintage shop 10 years ago. The same material is in my skirt that's in this top. That's so much fun.
It was probably purchased in Mexico. It was made in Mexico, hand-painted with these wonderful bands of mariachi players and then musical instruments and florals. And then, of course, it's got the added touch of the sequins, of the shining sequins. This probably was a piece that really was purchased and then worn in Mexico. Might not necessarily have been worn when back at home.
The dress I admired was a gift to the museum by the estate of the late Peggy Cohn. There are several significant pieces in the show which were hers. Cohn, a stylist for Atlantic Records, was later a popular New York performer. She wore vintage beautifully as she led her own swing band called Peggy Cohn and the Central Park Stompers.
"My dad treats me so darn good. He gives me everything a sweet lover should. But when he's gone and I'm feeling blue, solution, this is what I do. I'll go shopping."
The Cocktail Culture exhibit is as much about attitude as anything else. Are we so very different today? Even as economic times grow harder, we long for style. Designer Matthew Bird.
The harder the times, the more you sort of need an outlet of some kind. And alcohol can be one, and it can be a valid one. It doesn't have to be a life of debauchery. It could just be a way to relax after a hard day that wasn't getting you anywhere. And I see we're certainly not in the Great Depression now, but we're on tough times. So I can't help but think that the whole focus on the 1950s, especially right now, is harkening back to a time when these systems worked better, and also a time when we imagined that we knew how to relax a little bit better than we do now.
Which may help to explain the popularity of the Cocktail Culture Show, an advertisement for a film from 1933 called The Cocktail Hour, sums it up. Take one bewitching girl, three lovelorn men, a quarter gaiety, a half romance, one quarter remorse. Add a dash of moonlight and music, sweeten with lover's lies, then add a dash of bitters and decorate with colorful gowns in season. That's the Cocktail Hour. All the party is missing is you. And to see a slideshow of the Cocktail Culture exhibit, go to our website, npr.org. Tonight, Broadway celebrates the end of the season with the 65th annual Tony Awards, the Great White Way's version of the Oscars. It's been a banner year for Broadway, with over $1 billion in box office receipts and some sparkling performances. Reporter Jeff London profiles two of this season's best acting nominees.
There are three names above the marquee at the Court Theater, where a revival of Garson Kanin's 1946 comedy, Born Yesterday, is playing. Two of them are familiar TV names, Jim Belushi, who plays a corrupt businessman, and Robert Sean Leonard, who plays a virtuous reporter. But audiences might be forgiven if they've never heard of the third name, Nina Arianda, who plays the not-so-dumb blonde Billy Dawn, the pivotal role made famous on Broadway and in film by Judy Holliday. It was certainly a question Robert Sean Leonard had when his agent called, offering him the part.
I said to my agent, I love this play, I love this role, but I'm going to have to go on your word here. Is this the girl? Do they have the girl? And he said, this is her. This is who we've been waiting for. And boy, was he right.
I don't suppose you got a chance to read my piece.
What are you talking? Of course I did, twice.
What do you think?
Well, I think it is the best thing I ever read. I didn't understand one word.
Nina Arianda, at age 26, is making her Broadway debut in Born Yesterday. She received rave reviews for her performance, but admits she was nervous taking on a role so identified with another actress.
I thought, okay, why is it iconic? Is it because of Judy Holliday? I think it's become that, but I think it stems from the text. And the text is timeless, and the text is fantastic, and it makes a performance iconic. So if I thought of it that way, it took a little pressure off myself and allowed me to kind of do exactly what I could do, which was just do it my way.
Let me ask you. You're one of these talkers? Or would you be interested in a little action?
Huh?
I got a yen for you right off.
Hmm. Do you get many?
Now and then.
What do you do about them?
Stick around, you'll find out.
Arianda's career has been on a fast track since she got her graduate degree from NYU just 2 years ago. Last season, she made a splash in an off-Broadway show, Venus in Fur, and has since worked on several movies, including Woody Allen's latest, Midnight in Paris. Arianda got the stage bug as a child in Paterson, New Jersey. By the time she was 16, she was studying acting in a summer program at the Royal Academy in London. She well remembers going to the open-air Globe Theatre to see a production of Shakespeare's Cymbeline, directed and starring Tony-nominated actor Mark Rylance. She stood in front of the stage and says by the end of the play, she was sobbing.
And then he blew me a kiss off stage, and I was just, that even worsened my sobs. But that was one of those theater moments that kind of really makes you want it more. You know, when you see a performance like that, it makes you want it even more. It gets you hungrier in a way.
A couple of blocks away at the Music Box Theater, that same Mark Rylance is starring in the Tony-nominated British import Jerusalem. It's been quite a year for him. This fall, he appeared in a Broadway revival of La Bête, where he played a vulgar 17th-century performer named Valère, and did a 25-minute tour de force monologue in rhyming couplets.
Valère was so innocent, so childlike, really. I mean, a terrible, terrible character. You wouldn't want to spend much time with him at all. But to play him was very immediate and like being a kind of insect, really.
What a foolish waste of time to count. Devotion comes to nothing if we come to summarize devotion in a sum. It's a tiny play on words.
As splashy as that was, Rylance's Tony nomination is for his role in Jerusalem, which has been described as a kind of state of the British nation play. His character, Johnny Rooster Byron, is a former daredevil who lives in the woods and deals drugs to teenagers. Rylance says Rooster cuts closer to the bone.
Rooster is more to do with me being 51 and the end of my life approaching, you know, still some years off, but that whole thing of being around 50 and thinking, well, you're not getting younger, and here's where we've been so far and where do we want to go, these kind of things. It throws me into much deeper waters as I approach performances and leave performances.
Byron tells tall tales, mixing the mythic with the contemporary.
All Byron boys are born with their own teeth. 32 chompers, hair in them's chest, no weeping, no wailing, talking straight off. This one, me, he sits up, wipes the dew from his eyes and calls, Mother, what is this dark place? And she replied, 'Tis England, my boy.
Playwright Jez Butterworth says he shaped the role of Rooster for Rylance after meeting him several years ago and discussing a very early draft of the play.
It was one of those meetings that you came away from when I first met him that you knew that this was going to be, you know, one of the important collaborations of your life. You just knew straight away.
And the result of that meeting, which has already won Rylance and Butterworth awards here and in England, could lead to a Tony Award for one or both of them tonight. The Tony Awards will be broadcast live on CBS at 8 p.m. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The lack of funds is not a problem for the Ute, a tiny Native American tribe. The tribe has spent nearly $40 million on a new museum and cultural center. NPR's Netta Ulaby stopped by the opening in a remote corner of Colorado near the New Mexico border.
The party for this gorgeous new museum on the Southern Ute Reservation has a buffet of what you could call Ute Native cuisine. Chokecherry pate, elk tenderloin, and there was a live band. The spectacular building looks like a bristling metal teepee poking out of the desert. It was designed by a blue-chip architect and paid for by accident. When the U.S. government split the Ute people into three different tribes in the late 19th century, it sent most of them away.
We remained here.
Robert Birch runs the new museum's board.
And little did they know, we're sitting on oil, natural gas. And once we started getting it out of the ground, producing it, we became a wealthy tribe.
One of the wealthiest, in fact. Now there are less than 1,500 Southern Ute, but they're worth billions. The tribe is literally a case study in expert wealth management. They already had a museum.
But it was an awful little building, maybe not even 1,000 square feet.
And Birch says there wasn't anything in it the Southern Ute were really proud of.
So we decided to build a place where we could have a showcase for our children and grandchildren, and they would always know their culture.
And maybe attract tourists visiting a nearby casino built to diversify the tribe's portfolio. Matthew Box is drumming at the opening ceremony here. He's a former tribal chairman who says the Southern Ute were able to get back artifacts from private collectors and other museums, including the Smithsonian. Stuff like priceless white clay pottery and beadwork that's mind-bendingly intricate. But this is in some ways two museums, one for tourists and one for the Southern Ute. When I asked Matthew Box what in this museum meant most to him, he said,
"This one picture, which isn't an artifact or beadwork or a vest or anything. It is a picture that has my mother, my Uncle Leonard, my grandpa, and my dad, and myself. And we're all sitting around a drum."
Besides the expensive replicas of teepees and boarding school classrooms, there's a lot of big blown-up photos of the Southern Ute today.
There's you and hey. Johnny Man.
Where am I? There's Ian. There's my tattoo.
21-year-old Samantha Pacheco and her friend Ian Thompson say the museum feels a little bit like a family album. It's a small tribe, so everyone knows everyone.
There's Trav. There's me right there. See, there's me.
I'm back there. I'm probably dancing.
Pacheco and Thompson say being on display is nothing new. They spend weekends performing in powwows in places like state fairs.
We're usually, like, dancing or singing for everyone.
So everybody's usually looking at us.
We are literally a museum in a body.
Kind of right, yeah. There you go.
It feels good, they say, to have a place where they can finally look at themselves. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
I've come to know Gertrude Stein as a doyen of U.S. letters. She's at the center of two exhibitions currently up in San Francisco that tread on some pretty familiar territory, including her friendship and patronage of Pablo Picasso and other artists. But as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, the exhibitions also reveal some unfamiliar sides of Gertrude Stein.
Gertrude Stein enjoyed having her portrait done.
You can count some 25 artists who at one time or another asked her if she would model for them or sit for her portrait.
That's Wanda Korn, the curator of Seeing Gertrude Stein at the Contemporary Jewish Museum. Among the most famous portraits is a 1922 photo by Man Ray of Stein sitting with Alice B. Toklas in front of the fireplace in their Paris home. In the foreground, the two women sit comfortably in cushioned chairs. But your eyes get quickly drawn to the wall behind them, covered with paintings by famous friends such as Pablo Picasso, Juan Gris, and Henri Matisse.
It was really, in a manner of speaking, the first museum of modern art, there not being any such institution this early in the game.
Stein and her brother Leo were among the first to recognize the birth of modern art. They collected Picasso and Matisse before anyone understood their importance. Artists began to vie for a good spot on Stein's wall.
So when you were skied or high on the studio walls, you were perhaps an artist that was young and new to them, but the stronger you became in their eyes, then your work was likely to travel down to eye level.
Stein had a short haircut in a style that made her look a little like Julius Caesar. The resemblance wasn't lost on artist Pavel Chelichev. He was cast out of Stein's circle, so he made an ink and sepia drawing that has her in a toga, leaning back in a seat as if in a throne, holding a globe in one hand.
And that hand on the globe is very intentionally not only meant to be just the world in general, but the world of art, which he is saying she has much too much power and authority over.
While Stein is often portrayed as a lone figure, she is just as often seen with Alice Toklas, says Korn.
There was no Gertrude without Alice and no Alice without Gertrude. They were joined at the hip, so to speak, from the time they started their domestic partnership till death.
Stein and Toklas spent years promoting other artists, and all the while Stein was writing her own experimental fiction. Her big break, well documented in the exhibition with copies of early editions, was the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas.
And it was filled with good gossip and anecdotes and left bank lore.
It was an account of their life, written by Stein, but told from Toklas's point of view.
For most Americans, of course, they had never had any access to her because they hadn't gone to Paris or they hadn't been invited to her homes. And this was suddenly a real story from somebody that they knew only faintly.
Stein also did a series of collaborations with other artists. The exhibition has some footage of productions of her ballets and operas. One of them turned out to be a big hit.
Scene 11.
Pigeons on the grass, alas.
Pigeons on the grass, alas.
Four Saints in Three Acts caught people's attention with Stein's non-traditional libretto, its all-black cast, and its lyrical music by Virgil Thompson. It even had a successful Broadway run. In 1934, Stein did a tour of the United States, traveling from coast to coast, averaging two lectures a week. Americans loved her. The show has an interactive map of her tour and some of her readings, like this profile of Matisse.
And then, when he could not come to be certain that he had been wrong in doing what he had been doing, when he had completely convinced himself that he would not come to be certain that he had been wrong in doing what he had been doing, he was really certain then that he was a great one, and he certainly was a great one.
Most of the art that Stein collected can't be found in this show. But go down the street to the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art for an exhibition called The Steins Collect. Gertrude Stein's brother Michael and his wife Sarah lived around the corner in Paris. Janet Bishop is the curator.
They became, in these early years, Matisse's most important patrons and trusted confidants.
Michael and Sarah were close to Matisse, but Gertrude was closer to Picasso.
The Steins introduced Matisse and Picasso to each other, which, you know, had to have launched one of the greatest artistic rivalries in the history of art.
On Saturdays, both Stein households had salons, and many of their friends felt they had to choose. Going to Gertrude and Alice's meant you picked Picasso. Going to Sarah and Michael's put you in the Matisse camp. Fortunately, the exhibition, The Steins Collect, has all their works in one place. Though Stein's siblings were in many ways just as important as she was in helping discover and shape modern art, we mostly remember Gertrude because of her success as a writer and her love of her own image. Stein would probably approve of the many works done after her death that make up the last part of the exhibition at the Contemporary Jewish Museum. Curator Wanda Korn.
I wanted to be able to sort of put it all into a holistic concept for my audience and for people to be able to see her in her complexity rather than just to always reduce her to a single word.
This exhibition shows Stein in all her many guises as a mythical figure of the left bank, lesbian role model, feminist pioneer, a language innovator. Both shows will travel to the East Coast after they close here. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Summertime is when the big broadcast TV networks take a bit of a break, and cable networks roll out a lot of new shows. And Eric Deggans is here to help us sort through what to watch. He's the TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. Welcome back to the program, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get right to it. What should we be watching right now?
Well, maybe it's because I'm a man of a certain age, but I love this show called Men of a Certain Age on TNT. And it's this great comedy, dramedy, about three friends who are pushing 50. And one of the centerpieces of the show that I really love is they get together at a diner before their day starts, and they talk about the things that are really bothering them. And it can be anything like romantic trouble. In one case, it was about having their wallets in their back pockets.
What's that about?
What's that about? It's been getting old. Can't sit on my wallet anymore. I get all this ass bone trouble.
Ass bone trouble?
It's like slants me. It's the hip or the joint. It's all out of whack. I read about it, too. It's not good. No, wait, you told me about it.
Recognizable voices there.
That's right. We got Ray Romano playing the owner of a party supplies shop who also has dreams of playing in the senior PGA Tour. We've got Andre Brower who's playing a guy who's taken over his father's car dealership. So, you know, these guys are all at crisis points in their life. And they're coping with the big approaching 5-0, you know? If 40 is the new 20, then I guess 50 is the new 30.
Or the new period of constant angst. And it's an interesting show with really edgy camera work, but sometimes it seems like the centerpiece is the casting.
Oh, without a doubt. These are experienced actors who have created really compelling characters, and we're supposed to go along on the ride. And, you know, so much of television is focused on youth. You watch network television, and it's obviously aimed at 20-somethings. But this show is very much for those of us who are, you know, we're aware that we're getting older and we're facing different issues than we faced 20 years ago.
There are a few things that are rolling out throughout the summer on cable. Reach later into the calendar and tell us what we should be looking out for.
Well, anybody who reads my blog, The Feed, knows that I am a sci-fi geek, and so I am geeked up for this show called Torchwood, which started as a show on British television, but Starz, the premium cable channel, is doing, I guess I would say, a little more Americanized version. It's about what happens if everyone on the Earth suddenly stops dying. And Mekhi Phifer, if you remember him from ER, has an amazing turn as a CIA agent who finds himself wrapped up in the middle of this after he gets in a really bad car accident. And let's listen to a little bit of that.
I had a pole through my chest. I was dead, then I wasn't. I had to pay for this bridge. And now I want to know what is going on, all right? Because I was dead, and now I'm not.
I guess a question that the Undertakers of America would want to know also. People exactly. aren't dying anymore.
Exactly. This, believe it or not, not dying is one of the biggest dangers the Earth has ever faced.
Maybe this trend that I'm noticing is a lot of the shows on cable right now seem to have a very narrow focus on a very specific audience. Teen Wolf, Single Ladies, Franklin and Bash, which clearly is going after men of a different age, younger men with really gross taste.
Certainly younger, yes.
Yes. And The Protector, which is a show that seems to be focused on divorced mothers.
Yeah, that's a Lifetime show. Cable is an area where you really pick an audience and you super serve them. So, of course, if you're ever going to reinvent the Teen Wolf series, you do it on MTV, which is focused on youth. Why anybody would want to do that, I have no idea. And after watching the first episode of Teen Wolf, I have even less idea. but they tried. They gave it a game try, you know.
We're glad that you watch all that television for the rest of us.
Thank you very much.
That's Eric Deggans. He's the TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.